One is obviously inflation. If it rears its head again, markets see that as a tail risk today, but they absolutely don't see it as the base case. And if it became so, I think markets, you know, that's the second pillar of this bull market. So I think that will be very negative.
Hi, and welcome to Wealthion. I'm James Conner. Well, here we are in the middle of Q2, and we've had numerous companies report quarterly numbers, some good, some bad. We've also had some very disappointing economic data, and we've had some backpedaling out of the Fed. So there's a lot of economic cross currents. And to make sense of it all, I'm joined with Ben Laidler, global market strategist at trading and investment platform eToro. Ben, thank you very much for joining us today. How are things in London?
Hey, James. Thanks for having me back. Things are good. The sun's shining. Summer's around the corner. We're trying to ignore markets, but yeah, things are good.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. And people in London, they love to complain about the weather. So how has the spring been so far?
So you're going to ask me about the weather to give me the excuse to complain? It's pretty good. You know, the sun's shining. It's not raining. I'm just going to leave it at that.
And so you have a long weekend coming up, May Day weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. Can't beat a three-day weekend. Yeah, just around the corner.
So I am based in Toronto, and we also have a long weekend coming up in May. It's called Victoria Day, believe it or not. We're still hanging on to the British crown.
Yeah, so we call it, well, the most original name we can come up with is Early May Day Bank Holiday. I think we should have just stuck with the old sort of colonial name.
Yeah, very good. So let's talk about the economy. The last time we spoke, you were very bullish on the U.S. economy, but we recently saw a weaker than expected Q1 GDP number. It came in at 1.6% versus expectations of 2.4%. And some people might look at this and say this pullback is good because it's going to result in lower inflation. But what's your take on this GDP number and what's your view on the U.S. economy overall?
So I call it U.S. exceptionalism. You know, the rest of the world is sort of slowed down and we're looking for a recovery and everything else. And the US economy just continues to chug along at very strong rates. And what looked like a weak first quarter GDP report, actually, when you scratch the surface, I think was very strong. So I think the narrative here is the US economy absolutely slowing, but at a very modest pace. The two bits of the economy we really care about as investors, consumption and investments. Consumer spending in that first quarter report was 2.5%. And services spending, which is the biggest driver of the economy, was 4%. And investment, 3%. So, you know, these are the drivers of the economy. They remain very, you know, very strong. You know, the takeaways, which gave you that sort of low headline number, are basically the volatile, smaller bits that we don't really worry too much about, trade, inventories. And just to put all this in perspective, your long-term potential US GDP growth rate is something like 1.8%. So we are still running at, you know, very strong levels by historical standards.
Okay, so let's look at interest rates and also inflation. When we came into 2024, everybody was looking for six rate cuts. Then that got reduced down to three. And then after this last Fed announcement, I guess people are saying it's only going to be two cuts. And some people are saying now it's not going to be any. And this is all based on inflation expectations. And as you just alluded to, we had a very strong CPI number recently. Car insurance, for example, was up 22% year over year, the largest increase since 1976. So maybe you could just take us through your views on inflation in a little more detail.
So the economy is running hotter than expected, and therefore inflation's running a bit hotter than expected. That, I think, is probably the big takeaway. And this has driven a bit of a reset in expectations for not necessarily bad reasons. I think many of us would embrace a stronger economy and therefore stronger, you know, corporate earnings. But it has resulted in this reset of interest rate cut expectations coming into the year. Maybe a little bit off our heads, but we thought we were going to see six or seven cuts starting in March. Now, you know, here we are, and we're looking at maybe one cut starting in September. So we've seen a sort of big change, but markets have taken it in their stride. Why? Because it's been compensated by stronger growth and stronger earnings, A. And B, because I think the rate cuts are still coming, inflation is still falling, it's just been a bit stickier than expected. Headline rates are over 3%. The PCE numbers, which the Fed looks at, are, you know, under 3%, but it's those last hard yards. Why am I not panicking too much about it? Market long-term inflation expectations have really not budged. They're still in the sort of low 2% levels. And I think when you delve into the inflation numbers, the stickiness comes from a lot of these sort of backward-looking components like shelter, like healthcare, like insurance, that I do think will ultimately ease. Interest rates at 5.5%, I still think are restrictive. I think the backup in bond yields, which has just happened, is doing some of that slowdown work for the market. And I guess big picture, we're seeing a productivity boom in the US. Productivity rates, how much work that we get out of that 1 hour of work, are running about 2 times higher than normal levels. Why? Because the labor market's tight. Companies have to do more with what they have. And we're seeing this sort of tech boom, which is giving us all the tools to work more efficiently. But long story short, this is the secret sauce that allows us to see strong growth, but also lower inflation that keeps the door open for interest rate cuts later this year.
And just to clarify, you're expecting only one interest rate cut this year?
That's what that's what markets are pricing. I think we may see one or two. I'm not too worried about the timing or the magnitude. I think all we need to know is that, you know, the next move is down and it's coming within our sort of investment horizon over the next 6 months or so.
And we have a big election coming up in the US. And so therefore, if you want to do this before the US election, let's just say he's concerned about the impact or the optics associated with an interest rate cut ahead of the election. Do you think that's going to come into play at all? Or are you?
Yeah, a little bit at the margin. It's definitely going to mess with the timing a little bit. I think that's why everyone's focused on September, because the meeting after that, you're right in the teeth in the middle of the election. But whether it's September, whether it's December, I'm not actually too bothered. Again, because we still think inflation's falling. We still think the next move is down, not up for interest rates. And the fact that it's been a bit delayed and is going to be less than expected is for good reasons from an equity investor standpoint, which is that growth is strong and earnings are strong.
So another large component of CPI is energy, and we've had further hostilities in the Middle East, which could lead to higher oil prices at some point. Right now, WTI is hanging in the mid-80s, but are you concerned about the oil price and the impact that this might have on inflation going forward?
Well, I have to be a little bit humble here because, you know, when you look back at history, it's gasoline prices and oil prices that feed straight into those inflation expectations that you were, you know, alluding to. So it's absolutely a risk. If we see a spike in oil prices, it feeds straight through into consumer expectations for inflation, and the Fed, you know, has to respond to that. But I think that any significant move up in oil is sort of self-adjusting. You know, if we do see $100 oil for whatever reason, I think we will just drive less. Companies will work very hard to use less oil, A. And B, I think if oil ever gets that high, the temptation's going to be for OPEC just to pump more oil. And it's OPEC holding back about 5% of total global production from the market, which is making this market sort of so tight. So I think you have a couple of sort of self-adjustment mechanisms, which, you know, they may not protect us from oil, you know, going to 100, but they absolutely protect us, I think, from that sort of energy price shock of prices going higher than that.
So I'm based in Toronto, and we are paying about $1.70 a liter. I'm curious what you are paying for petrol in London.
So I'm not sure I can do the maths as quick as you, but we're paying about £1.50 a gallon in the UK, which I'm sure is higher than in Canada. I guess the big difference in the UK is, I think, tax. I think the government takes about over 50% of our petrol price.
Oh, yeah. It's at least 50% here, I'm telling you. Don't even get me started about Canadian politics and the economy.
Yeah, let's not go down the tax rabbit hole.
But and just for our American viewers, $1.70 a liter would equate to about $5 US gallon. So it's rather high. Ben, I want to ask you about the 10-year bond. It was at 4% in early March, and then it went to 4.60 to 4.70 here. What's this telling us? Is this telling us we're going to see a hard landing, or what's your take on it?
So I think it's telling us two things. It's telling us that the outlook has changed a little bit for inflation and interest rates. Stickier inflation, high for longer interest rates. I think that's absolutely pushed bond yields up. I think the other thing which is talked about less is the return of the term premium. This is the bit of bond yields which is driven not by inflation, not by growth, but by everything else. We've all forgotten about this for a decade because it was negative, but it's on the verge of turning positive. And it's this sort of catch-all, which I think reflects all the other worries that are beginning to come to fore in the market of the fiscal situation in the US, the debt situation in the US, the fact that we have this election in November, what's happening with quantitative tightening. So it's a little bit of a sort of annoying catch-all, but I think it's an important part of this move up in bond yields. It's not just about this reset of inflation expectations and when the Fed's going to cut interest rates. It's also these sort of other bubbling uncertainties. So what I think this means is that we're just going to have to get used to bond yields being, you know, a little bit higher than we might have expected 6 months ago.
And because we have seen higher than expected inflation numbers and then a lower GDP number, there's been a lot of chatter in the recent days about stagflation. Do you think this is a concern at all going forward?
I think what we've seen in the last few months is a reconsideration of the sort of tail risks. So whether it's inflation resurging, whether it's the Fed being forced to put interest rates up, not cut them, whether it's the return of sort of stagflation, I think these are things we're now talking about again, but I think they're still in the realm of sort of tail risks. But it does mean that some of the assets that most benefit from that, and commodities is sort of the obvious one, have been doing better in the last few months. And I think this is a reflection of, even though it's not my base case, people are now put a 10, 15, 20% possibility on these issues happening versus zero a few months ago. And that means that, you know, you're nibbling at some of these asset classes which have traditionally have done quite well in stagflationary environments or when inflation has returned. And it's absolutely been a big driver of oil prices that you talked about, or the sort of broader pickup in commodities in recent months.
So you mentioned earlier that you're looking for an interest rate cut in the U.S., possibly by September, maybe 1 to 2 cuts this year. The Swiss recently cut rates. Who do you think is the next country to cut interest rates?
Well, the short answer is going to be the ECB on June the 6th in terms of, you know, big central banks. And maybe here in the UK, we follow that at some point later in the summer. But I think that's going to be the big change. You know, we've seen a complete rollover in the global interest rate cycle in the last sort of 6 months or so. We started to see interest rate cuts out of Latin America and Eastern Europe. They were the first to raise. They're the first to cut. The Swiss National Bank, as you mentioned, was the first of the sort of big developed market central banks to cut. And I think Europe's going to be next. Why? Because Europe is almost in recession and inflation's running at sort of 2.5%. So the macro stars are there for them to cut. And I think it'll be very bullish because I think Europe is particularly sensitive to lower interest rates. They have higher debt, they have a weaker economy, inflation's already come down. So I think it's a key catalyst of a sort of more bullish story for Europe. But, you know, more globally, we've had 3 times as many rate cuts this year as rate hikes. And that's a complete turnaround from where we were even a year ago.
So let's move on now. And I want to get your thoughts on the U.S. stock market. And Q1 was very strong. We've seen some weakness here in the last couple of weeks. But many of the big tech names have reported mixed numbers. Google came out with a massive beat. It also initiated its first ever dividend. I was surprised to hear that. But they also said they're going to implement a $70 billion stock buyback. But we've had weak numbers out of Meta and also Tesla. And what are your views on the stock market? And are you concerned at all with this pullback that we've seen in both the S&P and the NASDAQ here in the last couple of weeks?
The short answer is no. We were absolutely overdue for the pullback that we've just seen in the last few weeks. I mean, just to throw a whole barrage of numbers at you, coming into this pullback, US stocks were annualizing their best year in 70 years. And we were just coming off a remorseless, low volatility 25% rally. So overdue for a pullback. Your average year in the S&P 500, you see three pullbacks. And we have now maybe just seen one. Your average intra-year drawdown in the S&P 500 is 14%. Average. And we're not even close to that. So we were overdue for some volatility. We've seen it now. And it's an opportunity. Stocks are now cheaper. All the money, all the people that were sitting on the sidelines and missed that rally, I think, and that should now be, and probably are, by the looks of what's going on in the market, beginning to sort of nibble at this pullback. And on earnings, you know, if we're getting less bullish about the magnitude of rate cuts, then that's the sort of less good news. The better news is earnings are being stronger than expected. 80% of the S&P 500 has beaten expectations so far this quarter. Every sector has beaten expectations. And big tech is doing the heavy lifting. Magnificent Seven earnings are expected up something like 40% this quarter. And the rest of the S&P 493 will basically be flat. Now, we expect that to rebalance over time. But right now, it's all about big tech. And, you know, Meta sold off, you know, 10% recently, despite reporting 27% sales growth. So, you know, it's quite a tough crowd when, you know, you have that sort of reaction. But, you know, big tech is, you know, really showing its strength here. I mean, we've seen very strong AI-driven numbers from Microsoft, from Google. So we're seeing the growth, but we're also seeing them just flex those financial muscles with, you know, they have net cash balance sheets, they have huge profit margins, and you're just beginning to see them. You know, when times get tough and they need to show shine the shareholders, they can do these dividends, they can do these big buybacks because they have this sort of embarrassment of riches.
So just to summarize a few of the points that you made, you're still bullish on the U.S. economy in spite of this pullback that we've seen in the GDP numbers, and you're still bullish on the U.S. stock market, once again, in spite of the pullback that we've seen here in recent weeks.
Absolutely. You're making me sound like a permabull, but yes, absolutely positive.
And once again, you're seeing this as an opportunity to get long.
I think so. I think we're in the early innings of a bull market. Your typical bull market is 4 to 5 years and 150%, and this one kicked off 6 months and 20% ago. So I think we're in the early innings. I think the pillars of this are a recovery of earnings and a soft landing in the US. And I think that remains on track. And the outlook for interest rate cuts. And I still think that's on the table. Maybe push back, maybe a little bit more delayed, but absolutely coming. Those are the twin pillars. And technically, I still think there's an awful lot of money on the sidelines. There's $6.5 trillion in US money market funds, which, if we get a big pullback, will step up. And I think, you know, play in this market. So yeah, structurally bullish. That doesn't mean along the way that we're not going to see some volatility, which maybe we're seeing now. It's always sort of two steps forward, one step back. But I think we're in the early innings of a bull market, and the pillars of that remain firmly in place.
So let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Britain. You are based in London, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. And I love that city, by the way, but it's so damn expensive. And because of my poor performing Canadian currency, every time I go there, it's costing me a small fortune. And just to buy a cup of coffee, I'm paying $8. But what's your take on what's happening in Britain and the economy?
Yeah, you should try living here rather than just visiting. No. So the UK is a sort of transatlantic economy. What I mean by that is that it has, you know, a lot of the European, continental European problems of this sort of growth stagnation verging on recession. But then it also has some of the problems the US is having, maybe the quality problem the US is having, of this very strong, you know, labor market, which is helping push up, you know, or helping keep inflation, you know, high. Growth in the UK is becoming less bad. Inflation has started to finally ease. And interest rate cuts are beginning to sort of come on the horizon. Maybe not as early as the ECB, but probably running ahead of the Fed. And I think this will be a particular relief in the UK, where debt levels are quite high. A lot of people have mortgages. A lot of those mortgages are fairly short term. And I think this is going to be pretty positive for the UK market, which everyone has just basically forgotten about over the last sort of decade or so. And that means that this market has just got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. It's trading at about 20% discount to the sort of long-term average. And I think its mix of sort of old economy stocks, sort of banks and commodities, is particularly sensitive to the recovery I think we're going to see in the sort of broader UK and European economy, and maybe also particularly sensitive to these lower UK interest rates taking some of the strength out of the pound.
You made mention of the fact that in the UK they have short-term mortgages, and we also have that here in Canada. You either get a three-year or a five-year mortgage. And I recently had a discussion with David Rosenberg, and he was expressing concern that he thinks we might see a reset in the Canadian housing market because of these short-term mortgages coming due. And people are, of course, going to be resetting at a much higher interest rate. Do you share any of those concerns with what might happen in the UK?
Absolutely. You know, debt levels are high. People are very exposed to interest rates in the mortgage market. And this is sort of a slow moving train wreck, given that, you know, it is this 3 to 5 year, you know, reset. And basically, we're in a race between those resets and lower interest rates. So absolutely, this is a significant drag on the economy. It's why interest rate cuts are so important. The UK is a particularly consumer driven market as well. So anything you're paying away extra to the bank in your mortgage payments is something you're not out spending in the shops. So yes, absolutely a big deal. But what I would say, though, is that everybody has known this. This is why the market's depressed. This is why the economy has been reasonably depressed. This is why I think interest rate cuts in the UK are a particular catalyst, given how interest rate sensitive the economy and the stock market are.
And your office is at Canary Wharf. And I'm always curious when I talk to people in other cities, what's happening in terms of the workforce. Is everybody back to the office 5 days a week, or are people working remotely, or is it hybrid?
Absolutely hybrid. And places like Canary Wharf, which is, you know, a office district with not a lot else going on, have been particularly hard hit by that.
And do you think this could be an issue going forward with the commercial real estate market?
I think it is an issue today. I mean, there's an awful lot of these buildings in Canary Wharf which are half empty or completely empty and will need to be repurposed. Some of them may be handed back to banks. So yeah, absolutely, I think it's an issue. But I guess similar to my comments on the mortgage market, your average commercial real estate loan is even longer than your average mortgage. So, you know, the least bad thing I can say about this is it's a 10-year workout, which everybody can see coming. And therefore, whilst negative, it won't be a surprise to anybody.
Ben, I want to move on now and get your thoughts on Bitcoin. Your firm has written extensively about Bitcoin as an investment class. And given its huge outperformance in the last couple of years, I want to get your thoughts on this. It's still up 50% on the year. It has pulled back from its high. And we recently went through this halving process. But what's your take on it now?
So I would say we're still very long-term bullish. And I would say two things. One, right now, you're seeing a classic supply-demand squeeze. We've seen these spot Bitcoin ETFs launched in the US back in January, which have collected over $12 billion of funds so far. It's probably been the most successful ETF launch in history. So we've seen a big pickup in demand. And then to your point, the Bitcoin halving is just further depressing supply growth, halving it. But we only have 6% of all Bitcoin still left to be issued from here. So this is your classic supply-demand squeeze in the short term, which is helping prices. And longer term, this is a big institutional adoption story. Professional investors dominate other asset classes 3-1 versus retail investors. Crypto is completely the opposite. Retail investors dominate it, and it's still a very small and very young asset class. This year, we're going to have new accounting regulations in the US, which make it easier for companies to own crypto. We're going to have new banking regulations, which make it easier for banks to own crypto. At some point, I think we're going to see a central bank step up and own crypto or Bitcoin as part of its reserves. So I think this whole institutionalization story is still to play out and is going to be very, very significant.
And you also cover the gold sector. What's your view on gold?
A bit more qualified on gold. I mean, it's been doing well. We've had seen new all-time highs. The drivers of that, central bank buying, geopolitics, people looking for safer havens. But outside of that, I'm just a little bit nervous. The traditional drivers of gold are not in place today. Bond yields are rising, not falling. The dollar is strengthening, not weakening. Flows into the gold ETFs. We're seeing outflows, not inflows. So I think this is sort of a low quality gold rally. And I'd just be a little bit cautious that it, you know, really has the legs here.
And so when it comes to speaking with investors, you speak to both institutional and retail investors. How do you reconcile the two investments? What are you suggesting investors do between allocating resources toward Bitcoin and or gold?
Well, I always say, you know, diversification is the quickest route to happiness in your investment portfolio. They both do sort of slightly different things. You know, I think gold is a great diversifier. It's obviously much more time tested than Bitcoin and has, you know, much lower volatility. Bitcoin, I think, has much higher returns and will continue to generate much higher returns, but it does it at the cost of much higher volatility. So I would own both, and I would own both in moderation as part of a diversified portfolio.
Ben, as we wrap up, you are very bullish on the U.S. economy and also the U.S. equity markets. If there was one risk to your thesis, what would it be?
Can I give you two? One is obviously inflation. If it rears its head again, markets see that as a tail risk today, but they absolutely don't see it as the base case. And if it became so, I think markets, you know, that's the second pillar of this bull market. So I think that would be very negative. I think the second one, which is maybe somewhat less appreciated, is just how supersized U.S. assets are. U.S. stocks are 65% of global market cap. Its bond markets are almost as big. Its dominance of the currency market is almost, you know, as big. Meaning that if I'm wrong on the U.S. economy, if something, you know, terrible happens at the election, if, you know, debt keeps rising, if the U.S. sort of really stumbles here, it will have a completely disproportionate impact on global capital markets.
Yeah, and you just touched on debt. We didn't even discuss that, but is that a concern with you at all? The U.S. debt levels are around $35 trillion and growing by $1 trillion every 100 days?
So the levels look manageable. The problem is the rate of change and the direction of travel and the seeming complete lack of political willingness to do anything about it. At some point, there will be a tipping point. And the bond market vigilantes will come back and they will force politicians to do something about it. I don't know when that's going to happen. But yes, it's absolutely one of those sort of tail risks which sort of lurks over the shoulder. It's beginning to feed into things like that term premium discussion in the bond market I talked about. Not a huge issue today, but could easily become one in the not too distant future.
Well, listen, that was a great discussion, Ben, and I want to thank you for spending time with us today. And if someone would like to follow you online and read about your thoughts, where can they go?
So you can find us on eToro.com, or you can find me on Twitter, where we publish every day.
Great. Once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Ben Laidler, and it provided you with some guidance on what to expect in the coming months. As we just discussed, navigating the financial markets and planning for your financial future can be a daunting task. And if you would like help with that process, consider having a discussion with a Wealthion endorsed financial advisor at Wealthion.com. We've aligned ourselves with some amazing wealth advisors that can help you plan for your financial future. And you can learn more at Wealthion.com. If you have any suggestions on who else you would like to see interviewed on our channel, please let us know in the comments section below. Once again, I want to thank you for spending time with us today, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.